nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Print them out and turn each page when you hear the following sound. Enjoy the show.
So this is the final lecture of the overview class, the 582, and I'm just going to go through and talk about analytical microscopy in a cursory fashion, so you're aware of what's involved in it and how to collect the data and what the data can tell you and what the limits are. We're going to do this by just a quick review of elastic and inelastic scattering, and then EDS, EELS, and energy-filtered imaging being the three primary methods that we'll discuss, and really the three primary methods that are used in the TEM, okay? Right, we showed this graph earlier, and now you have a bit more sense of how some of these things work, right? And really, we mentioned that if you have an electron come into your sample, there's multiple possibilities for the scatter of that electron with the atoms and different signals that come out, right? You can use the secondary electrons for the scanning electron microscopy, backscattered electrons in the SEM for compositionally sensitive imaging, Auger electrons in some specialized microscope situations. The transmission electron diffraction and the TEM are all involved with elastically scattered electrons. And then really the two primary analytical modes in the microscope are energy dispersive spectroscopy and inelastic scattered electron energy loss spectroscopy. And the idea here again is that as your electron comes in, it can undergo energy loss events which result in signals that you can collect and use those signals to determine the composition of the sample. Okay, so let's just start with EDS. EDS is a very common technique in both the TEM and the SEM. The thing to remember is that we have all sorts of different possibilities for inelastic scattering in the microscope. There are plasmon scatters, there's elastic scatter, and this is just, again, a plot of the relative probability of the different types of ionization. You'll recall I showed this one earlier, and I got confused a bit in class because I just had a bit of tiredness that day. And again, the possibilities of the O and the N and the M and the L are higher as you go to the outer shells, and that should make some sense, right? Because if you have outer shell electrons, it takes less energy to remove them, right? I don't know why I mind blanked on that day. But that said, we will generally use the K shells, the L shells, and the M shells during energy dispersive spectroscopy. And then to remind again, the way that this works, the electron comes in with some large energy. If it happens to interact with an inner shell electron, it can cause that inner shell electron to be ejected, right? It can part some of its energy to that inner shell electron. And in doing so, the atom becomes excited. It ends up in an excited state, and it doesn't like to be there. So it will find another electron in a higher energy state to transition down. And in the course of doing that, an X-ray photon is emitted. That X-ray photon is thus characteristic of the energy difference between the shells from which the electron came and down to which it goes. And thus, for every element, the photons that will come out will tell you what the element is. There are some overlaps, of course, but generally, you can use the measurement of the energy of that photon to distinguish what atom is where. Okay, so that's the core point of it. And then EDS spectroscopy is based on trying to understand the collection of those X-rays and how to analyze the data that you get for quantification and for qualitative information as well. Okay, so again, a very simple process, and you should have this one down in your head by now. But the electron comes in, happens to impart some energy, knocks an electron off a shell, you have a transition down, and X-rays result. Okay. Additionally, of course, in doing this, the incoming electron loses a particular amount of energy, and that is the core of energy loss spectroscopy, is measuring how much energy the incident electron lost. So it's the same ionization event that's important. It's just a matter of whether you detect the X-rays or you detect the loss in energy of the electrons. Okay. In the case of EDS, we're working on trying to understand what are the energies of the X-ray photons that come off, okay? There's lots of them, and again, we have the possibility of seeing all sorts of different transitions as we go from different subshells in the higher energy states down to the lower energy states, and you will generally see mostly K and L and M type events, and those are the ones that we tend to find showing up on our spectrum most commonly. You can usually see the alpha and beta and resolve those in many cases. The gammas and the deltas don't tend to be seen. But it can depend on the resolution of the spectrometer and the like. There's developments to improve spectrometer resolution that have been ongoing now for quite a number of years. It's called a bolometer detector, and I keep hearing about it, but I haven't really seen it so much for sale, so that's interesting. It must be a lot more difficult than they planned. So the resolution of the detector is usually on the order of about 150, 149 EV, usually is what you buy now. And so you can usually distinguish between alpha and betas, but it's often harder in some of the other cases. Another thing that's important when understanding EDS is that the relative yield of X-ray photons depends on the element that's being interrogated. If you are in the lighter weight materials, basically anything below beryllium, you do not see this process occur at all. You instead have only the Auger-type processes occur. For boron and above, you can detect X-ray photons, but you will note that the efficiency of X-ray photon production is low for the lighter weight elements, and most of the processes that result are instead Auger electron. And so we can do carbon, nitrogen, and oxygen when doing EDS, but you'll find that the signals are relatively low in comparison to the heavy elements. And so in the TEM, it's kind of more common to use electron energy loss spectroscopy for the light elements and then to use EDS for the heavy elements. And again, the reason for this is just due to the difference in how many photons come off in the process. All right. Also, we have in every case this continuous background radiation that can be present in our, that will be present in our spectra. This is basically if we have an electron that comes in and slows down some amount by interacting with the electron cloud around or the nucleus itself. It's mostly the nucleus in this case. You have some X-rays that are emitted. There's a continuous range of energies because there's a continuous range of electron energy loss that can happen. And so this results in a background that is continuous and is additive to the characteristic X-rays that appear. So this is plotting a kind of a theoretical look on what these sorts of EDS spectra look like, showing intensity versus energy. There's some background, and then at particular values of energy, you see these characteristic energy peaks associated with characteristic loss events in the sample. Okay, so the background is always there, and it's something you have to be aware of and subtract. All right. The other thing about EDS is you have to think about where the X-rays are coming from. One of the nice things about the transmission electron microscope is because our sample is relatively thin and because our electron energies are high, we tend to have most of the X-rays coming from where we place the beam. There is very little broadening of the beam due to scatter of the electrons. And so if you put in a very small probe at the top of the sample, it does not broaden significantly by the time it comes to the bottom of the sample. If instead you're doing something in scanning electron microscopy, it depends very strongly on the beam voltage. It depends very strongly on the material you're considering. But you will see large-scale broadening due to the fact that it's a bulk sample. The electron can come in and undergo multiple collisions. You can have the production of additional X-rays from the X-rays that come off from a single collision. That's called X-ray fluorescence. And so your volume from which the signal is coming can be relatively large. All right. So EDS in the TEM, because the sample is thin, the probe size is on the order of where you get the signal. But in the SEM, you can get a much larger area contributing to the energy dispersive signal that you collect. And that's because it's a bulk sample, and you can have multiple collisions through the depth of the sample. Okay? So that's an important part of the scattering physics to remember. In order to do this carefully, if you're trying to really understand your EDS work, people will go through and use what's called a Monte Carlo simulation. You can find these for free on the web. Usually these days when you buy your EDS spectrometer, the company that sells you the software has this built in. And what it does is you say, okay, I'm coming in with this beam energy. I'm looking at this particular material. Can you please calculate for me the relative amount of broadening due to the presence of multiple scattering events? And these little outputs like this will just come out of this of the software. Again, when I was a young man, you know, this was something you had to go through and know the guy who wrote the program and ask him for a copy and load it in Fortran or whatever. But now it just comes with your software, so that's very nice, okay? And it's very easy to use. But the thing that's nice about that is you can go through and have a better sense as to, you know, how much spatial broadening you get for your particular imaging situation. Another thing that can happen is, let's pretend you're looking at a thin film on a substrate where you have, say, you know, an aluminum thin film on a silicon substrate. You can go through and simulate through multiple layers and see how the beam broadening varies in the different materials as well. And that can be useful and give you more of a sense as to where your signal's coming from. Okay, in EDS, we have to go through and understand what the spectra look like. These are some typical EDS spectra, again, just stolen from the Williams and Carter book, as all of these figures are in most cases. The typical signal has some number of counts on the y-axis, and then you have a dispersion of energies on the x-axis. That's the origin of the name energy dispersive spectroscopy. And all you will see is you will see at particular values of energy a much higher count versus what's present in the background. Okay, typical signals, you know, you want to have, if you can, several thousand counts. That means that you will have a relatively high signal to quote-unquote noise. In other words, the amount of signal that you collect versus the Bremsstrahlung background will be large, and so it's useful to have a very high number of counts. The count rate is determined by how long you dwell on a particular time. And so if you want, you know, to get a larger number of counts, you just place the beam there for longer, hope that your sample does not drift much, and count. You also hope that you don't destroy your sample by having lots of energy put into the sample, right? So you need to be aware of that as well. But generally, you'll just place the probe where you want and collect a lot of signal, okay? Different examples, again, shown here. You're seeing K alpha, K beta. In this case, there's a sufficient split between these to easily resolve the K alpha and the K beta. In other cases, you're finding, let's see, there's some examples of, these are all Ks. This is all showing just the Ks on this particular case. I'll show you another one there. But, you know, not much to it. You just see intensity as a function of loss, and the particular value of the energy is corresponding to that element. The software will give you suggestions usually. You can use your intelligence to figure out whether those suggestions are good, and then you're good, okay? Yes, sir?
When it just shows that it's just K, are we assuming that it's K alpha, just K alpha?
Yeah, well, or the K alpha and the K beta overlapped sufficiently that you can't resolve them. And so if we were to look at the one, let's just look at the silicon one here. If you were to go in and plot it just from the point of 1.5 to 2.0 and spread that out, you would probably see that there's a little hump on the right-hand side due to the presence of the alpha and the beta. And what's nice is most of the modern software, you know, when it's all calibrated out, they'll draw straight lines indicating where this peak should be exactly, and it helps your eye understand when you have little, when your spectra has non-continuity in that curve, you can say, oh, it's from alpha or beta. So that's a good question, Jason. So just to repeat, Jason asked, you know, why is it that when it just shows K, why do we not know if there's a K alpha or a K beta? And it's simply because of the resolution of the spectrometer. Again, the resolution, so you're looking here at numbers in kiloelectron volts, right? And so the resolution on the spectrometers these days is around, I think it's 139 EV for magnesium K alpha or something is what they usually. 133, thank you, Lior. It depends on the spectrometer, but it's something like that. So in other words, he bought one recently or wrote a paper about the use of one. But it's around 130, 140 EV. And so that's usually quoted at the magnesium K alpha, which sits somewhere around 2 keV, I think. And that's just what the standard is for comparing. What is it? 1254. All right, so we should have Lior teaching this portion of the class. The real thing is I don't have an EDS detector on my machine at the moment, so it's been a couple years since I've done much of it, so I lose track of some of these details. So again, that's just a way to compare. And it used to be that when you bought detectors, you know, the manufacturers would, and maybe they still do, but it always seems like they tout the resolution by saying that my magnesium K alpha resolution is better than everybody else's. And in the end, they're all pretty close, right? And again, it's more about which software you find to be preferable generally these days. These things can be very complicated. This is another spectra. I believe this is taken from the Reimer text. And you can see here, you know, lots of different stuff, titaniums, tungstens, lanthanums. But again, you're starting to see the K alpha and the K beta clearly resolved here. You're seeing some presence of L alphas, right? L betas, L beta 1, L beta 2, right? So just these are heavier elements, and so you're getting more possibility of scatter from the higher electron states showing up. And again, you're seeing that these things are you know, relatively well resolved in particular cases. And you can have some overlap. So let's look on the bottom portion of this around 1.5 to 2 eV, right? And you see that the presence of the titanium L alpha there, it's a little small peak, and it's almost obscured by the tungsten M, whatever that squiggle is. I can't remember my Greek. And so, you know, these things are overlapped peaks. And so that causes some problems with quantification, right? Because if you're trying to, and we'll talk about quantification, but if you're trying to talk about how many counts there are within a given a peak, then you have to go through and do a little bit of a peak fit on that. And again, most of the modern software has some tools in there for doing that. But again, this is a fairly atypical but nice example of a spectrum that shows lots of different energy loss events within it. One other thing to note, I'll go ahead and point this back one step. This is plotted for various energy scales, and it depends largely on what you're looking at. In the case of the transmission electron microscope, because we are always coming in with at least 80 kilovolts of incident electron energy, you stimulate lots and lots of different stuff. If you are using the scanning electron microscope for doing SEM, and you use a relatively low voltage in imaging, such as, say, a 2kV imaging mode, you cannot obviously excite any of these processes that require more than 2kEV, right? So in the SEM, you have to remember that if you're looking for something that's a relatively large number of EV in terms of the photon energy, you have to make sure that your incident electron energy is larger than that in order to detect it. In other words, you cannot create energy for free. Okay, so that's just something to remember. In the TEM, it's not a problem. And again, this is shown here on the second more complicated graph. You see all the way out to 60s and 70s because we have lots of energy in the incident electron beam. Okay? Okay. So how does EDS work practically? The idea is that you have a detector that sits and looks at your sample. This is a drawing or a schematic of what the objective lens region looks like. You have the upper pole piece, the lower pole piece, a sample, your incident beam comes in, you get some transmitted electrons, you have your scattering events happen there, and then there's actually you get X-rays coming off at all angles, okay? So the production of X-rays is not forward-directed, it comes off at all the angles that are present. You put a detector in, and that detector only can capture some small amount of that angular distribution of X-rays, right? You will get a detector, and when you purchase your detector, you can choose the size of the chip that's being used to do this. If you're really trying to maximize the EDS capabilities, you'll try to get a bigger chip in there. It's a matter of whether or not you have the room in the objective lens pole piece. So the detector only detects a relatively small sub-angle of the overall photon production, and thus energy dispersive spectroscopy is not particularly efficient, right? You're having electrons come in, lots of X-rays come out in comparison to the number that you're actually able to detect, okay? Because your detector sits in just one place in this spherical area, okay? You'll often go through and tilt the sample so that you kind of have no shadowing of the grid or no shadowing of the sample holder, right? If you have the grid stuck down in your sample holder, then you may be in a position where some of the X-rays get banged into your sample holder. So it's generally done where you tilt the thing towards the detector so you don't have anything in the way, okay? That's a usual thing. If you are someone that's really trying to focus on energy dispersive spectroscopy and make an analytical microscope, you tend to use a relatively large pole gap so that you can have this tilt, so that you can have a larger detector in there. And so these tend to be called analytical pole pieces, ones that have a relatively large gap. Of course, as your gap goes up, your spherical aberration coefficient goes up, your resolution goes down. And so analytical microscopes, there's sometimes a trade-off there that you make when you buy your microscope as to whether you're going to focus on analytical or high resolution. Okay? All right. So the detector just sits and looks at this and collects the X-rays. The way that the detector works, it's a piece of silicon usually. Sometimes people will use germanium, but it's usually these days silicon. It's doped with lithium, and you are creating a PIN junction. And so the idea is you're basically creating an area that the electrons can come in, pardon me, not the electrons, that the photons can come in, create electron hole pairs, you bias this PIN junction, and thus the electron hole pairs that are created are collected at either end, right? Swept to one side or the other, depending on which carrier it is and the direction of the junction. You count the number of electron hole pairs, and it turns out that the number of electron hole pairs that are generated is proportional to the energy of the photons that come in, okay? And so what you do is you have the detector there, a photon comes in, it creates some number of electron hole pairs, you count those, and that is assigned to and calibrated to a particular energy, all right? In the course of doing this, you do it not in parallel. You don't just open up the detector and count a bunch of stuff, because if you have multiple X-rays come in during the time of collection, you will get more electron hole pairs, and you will lose that ability to discriminate the number of electron hole pairs with respect to the energy of the photon. And so they shutter this thing, right, collect, shutter, collect, right, so that you can serially count the photons as they come in, right? You do it quickly, so as you look at this show up on the screen, it appears as though it's happening in parallel. Your intensities rise across all the energy ranges, click, 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 up, 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 right? But it's because a lot of these events are happening in the microsecond time scale, and you show it up on the TV screen every, you know, you're on your monitor every some portion of a second, okay? So you have lots of things happening before you see the update or refresh on your screen. There's issues with this, too, is that if you have too many X-rays come off and come into your detector for the chosen time that you've used to collect, then you will have multiple X-rays entering and causing multiple electron hole pairs and having this loss of ability to discriminate between what's what. And so when you set up the detector and you set up your imaging conditions or your collection conditions, there's a thing called the dead time, and it's just a little lever on the software usually where you choose how long to take each of these serial collection points. And you time it so that there's a sufficient amount of time that nothing's being collected, that you don't have a probability of multiple X-ray photons coming in during the same collection increment. Practically what that means is you dial the dead time number so that it's around 30% dead time, and that's where you get the maximum collection. Okay? Yes, sir? Pardon me? And so that's right. And so as I said, it depends on how many X-ray photons you come out. So if your beam intensity is higher or you're focused more strongly on an area, right, the number of X-ray photons will increase. And so it does calibrate with the beam intensity that you are using. In that regard, if you are, you know, trying to take a map, you can do EDS from point to point and map that out. Your goal is to have lots of beam intensity and a short collection time so that you can get a nice collection from a large area without having much drift, for example. So all of these things in practice, you balance the intensity of your incident electron beam and the spectrometer characteristics to get good collection rates, but not too good of a collection rate, because if you get too good of a collection rate, you have an inability to discriminate multiple photons counted at the same time, okay? There's another thing that can happen is, of course, an X-ray photon can come into the silicon, and it can create a silicon X-ray photon, okay? You can fluoresce within the detector itself, and so sometimes if you're counting lots and lots of X-ray photons, you will see what's called an escape peak, and that's shifted by some particular energy I can't remember right now that's associated with the creation of a silicon K X-ray. So if you have lots and lots of titanium Ks, you will see sometimes an extra peak over at 1.4 EV or KEV to the right of that, because that's a titanium X-ray that came into the detector and in the course of the time that it's counting created another photon of silicon. And that also creates electron hole pairs subsequently, and it's all counted together, okay? So sometimes you will find a peak that you can't quite identify. And again, most of the modern software will suggest to you that that's an escape peak, but the older software doesn't. And you need to be aware that if you have it, some energy I can't remember, displaced from there. It's like 1.4, something like that, 1.4 kV. Then that is because you've got so many counts in there that you're creating silicon X-rays within the detector itself. Okay, so that's another thing to be aware of. EDS can be very complicated to do really, really properly, right? I'm giving an overview on it. And it's something that it takes some experience to look at and make judgments on and understand the spectra well. Also, there's, you know, the automation of this is great, right? It makes it easy to do. Please use intelligence, right? If it's suggesting to you that you have uranium in your sample and you really don't think that's possible, check the calibration, you know, something, just to make sure that what you're getting makes some sense. There's a fellow at NIST, Dale Newberry, who's one of, if not the one of the most, if not most knowledgeable persons about EDS spectroscopy. He's actually, I think, a NIST fellow now. And he gives a great talk, almost on demand, about these new softwares and how great, quote-unquote, they are at giving you all this information, but then he goes and shows you the actual information and how the software can make errors based on assumptions, and it's a very useful reminder to people, because you know it's just like any type of experimental thing. Just because the software tells you something doesn't mean it's right. Use your head. Think about why do I have copper? I shouldn't have copper in this. Copper is a real common one, right? Because often you're using a copper grid, right? Your sample supported on a copper grid. And so your X-rays come off your sample, they bounce into the copper grid, and they create copper X-rays, right? So, okay, and if you're trying to quantify copper, then don't use a copper grid. Use a molybdenum grid. Use a nickel grid, something else that's going to give you a different spurious X-ray, okay? So use your head with all this, and it takes some practice, okay? Okay, spurious X-rays, there you go. I knew that was coming up. Yes, Lior. You have to use a standard. Okay, so when you first install your detector, you put in a known standard, and the software will help you calibrate the spectrometer. Okay, so there's a NIST standard that you can buy, from one of the companies really inexpensively. It's a nickel oxide, I think, usually, and the nickel peaks here, the oxide peaks there. You tell the spectrometer, okay, that's nickel, calibrate here, and then you calibrate the oxygen, and then that disperses, right, over the available channels, the right values of the energy.
So calibrate it only 1-3 or something?
Hopefully, yes. You calibrate it until you, they usually stay quite fine until something goes wrong, like someone accidentally kicks the cord out on the thing, or whatever, okay? It's usually the calibration holds pretty well, but just keep your mind out, hey, right? Maybe the guy using it before you was not one of your better users and did something he wasn't supposed to, okay? That's one of the nice things about modern software, right, is that these things are now usually in an administrator function, right, as opposed to you can have different levels of function availability to new students versus senior students, and that's always very nice because it limits but doesn't prevent the possibility of something getting screwed up that way. So I was also commenting on spurious X-rays, right? The energy of the electron that comes in is high. The energies of the X-ray photons that comes out are high. Things like 2 keV, that's a lot of energy, right? And so those X-ray photons that come out can cause other types of X-ray photons to come out of other parts of the system, right? So you can have, here's an example of a specimen that's tilted nicely to the detector, but some of the continuous Bremsstrahlung, which is a forward scatter, can cause, emission off of, say, the anti-contaminator, liquid nitrogen, cold finger, the pole piece. Some of these guys can bounce back up and hit the upper pole piece, whatever. They can come off commonly and hit your sample holder, right? And so your sample holder can generate X-rays. If you are, again, doing analytical microscopy all the time, you will purchase a beryllium holder usually because the beryllium doesn't produce X-rays. Beryllium, of course, is a very unpleasant metal to machine, and so those holders are very expensive. It turns out there's only maybe one or two people in America that machine beryllium, because you if you get beryllium dust in the air, it'll kill you. They're very expensive holders, but you do use them in analytical microscopy. It's also a very brittle metal, so do not drop your beryllium holder or you're going to lose it, okay? But that's something to just remember, just generally, okay? All right, and this is just a reminder. I talked about this safety-wise too, right? Is that there is a lot of energy in all of this. Your electron comes in and does this scattering experiment, which is what the point of the microscope is, but there's a lot of energy coming off of these things, and there's x-rays coming off all over the place, right? So when you install your microscope, you turn it on, the first thing you do is you have your Geiger counter there to make sure that everything's sealed up properly. If you fool around with any portion of your microscope, you move it from point A to point B, you decide that you want to add a new detector, you decide that the stage isn't working right, whatever, make sure that the Geiger counter is something that you have purchased with the machine so that it's easy to use and to check to make sure there's no x-rays coming off, because they can, again, really, really hurt you. Okay. Now, not only can you use energy dispersive spectroscopy to determine what's in your sample, with some more care, you can actually determine how much of what is in your sample. It can be quantified. It's actually fairly easy to do. It's because the background's pretty straightforward. It's easy to subtract off the Bremsstrahlung background. And then all you do is you say, look, I'm trying to find out the number of counts in the chromium K-alpha, right? And you'll say, okay, this is what the background looks like. It's got some slope to it. You'll take a background pre-peak, post-peak. You'll estimate where what it would be in here. And then you just count the number of counts through that particular intensity. And then the way that you quantify is you use what's called the Clif-Lorimar method. And this is so simple, it seems like it shouldn't work. Okay? It's just, why would something this simple work? But really, all you do is you take a standard, you take a material where you know the answer of how much composition A versus composition B you have, and you say, okay, I'm going to stick in this known standard, and I'm going to take a nice long spectra, and I'm going to get the intensity of silicon versus carbon, okay? And I know that it's 50-50 silicon carbon, it's a silicon carbide, right? You go through and you measure the intensity of silicon versus carbon, and you have 50 versus, you know, 0.5 versus 0.5, and then you will, you know, this is now 1, this is the intensity that you measure, and you just then are going to calculate and find out what this thing, this Ka sub b, this Clif-Lorimar constant is. And so the thing about this is a constant now that you can use for subsequent unknowns. And so if you have, you know, silicon 22% and carbon whatever the remainder there is, 78%, then you would have a constant number here and you would measure the new intensities and get this out on the other side, okay? So it's very easy to do. It's not always easy to find a good standard, right? If you're trying to do this carefully, you need to have very good knowledge of what the composition of your standard is, and that can sometimes be a little difficult. There are a number of NIST available standards that have lots of the elements. People tend to use different rock elements because they have nice ratios of magnesiums and silicons and aluminums in them. But that can help you do that. But it's something you have to figure out. But then once you have this, you know, you go through and you find your K, your Clif-Lorimar factor for your given situation, and you're done. Okay. Now, it is not something that's a constant that is you know, for silicon and carbon, it's not 1.23 everywhere throughout the universe. It's a constant that's only true for your particular microscope, the particulars of your geometry that you're using. And so to do this, you have to calibrate every microscope that you, you know, every element that you're interested in on your own microscope. So it's a bit tedious, but it's really quite easy to do, okay? Not that hard of a thing to take care of. Simple. Quantification in EDS, you get your intensities for a known standard, you do this ratio, you find out the Clif-Lorimar factor. Now every time you put in an unknown, you again ratio the intensities of the two things, multiplied by the Clif-Lorimar factor, and then you have the relative concentration of the two things that are there. So very simple to do. And EDS is nice for that. Okay? So that's EDS, right? And it's used all the time for doing qualitative information, you know, what do I have? And then quantification is really quite possible with it. Again, not only can you look at the x-rays that come off, but you can also, if you have the appropriate stuff on your microscope, look at the loss of the incoming electrons, the amount of energy that the incoming electrons lose in these transitions. So they start off at 100 keV, they cause a particular transition, they will now be, you know, 99.75 keV in energy, and you measure that. And that's electron energy loss spectroscopy. And again, the particulars of the energy that they've lost is characteristic of the atom that they interacted with. And so you can use that to understand what you have. All right? So the way that this works is at the bottom of the microscope, you put in an electron energy loss spectrometer. It's a magnetic biprism. And basically what you're doing is you're taking in electrons into this magnetic biprism. The electrons that lose the most energy are bent the most by this fixed magnetic field. And those that lose the least energy are bent the least. And so what it essentially does is it acts just like the prism that you learned as a child that takes white light in and gives you colored light out on the other side. Okay? So essentially what you're doing with the EEL spectrometer is you're coloring the electrons, right, by the amount of energy that they've lost. Okay? You're creating a dispersion, right? A dispersion being a way of plotting out changes in energy, and then you can just detect that on the other side of the spectrometer. Okay? So it's a very simple idea. And you know, there it is again, shown in the upper right with the prism, you know, the Pink Floyd emblem, right? Okay, so what does EELs look like? Well, that's a little different. And it's a little bit more complicated than EDS. In EDS, you have a peak. That peak is centered on the characteristic energy. There's some breadth to that peak due to instrumental broadening, but that's it. A peak's a peak's a peak. Every peak looks like the other peak, right? You can have overlap of peaks, and that's where you get a little complication, but that's about it. In EELs, you are not detecting peaks. You are detecting, instead, an edge, and the differentiation there is that it's an onset edge. The electron that comes in can lose a particular amount of energy due to the interaction, and then you find a range of energy states above that onset edge that have to do with where that electron scatters into as it moves down the column. I mean, it moves down through the sample, sorry. So what you're looking at is you see some sort of a background. Let's look on the upper right here. This is a very idealized one for a K-edge. You see some sort of background, and then you'll see a particular point that is the onset edge, and then you'll see more background on top of that. And so what you find is that your spectra have a lot of interesting information in them depending on what states they can scatter into, the electrons can scatter into. In general, with EELs, you like to have a single scattering type of thickness. You like to operate at around one mean free path of sample thickness, so you have a high probability of a single scattering event, right? If you do that, you can get very nice background subtraction and have good looks on what these edges look like. You can put them in the right place and learn some things about them. Generally, in EELs, the type of sample thickness that you're using is a little bit thicker than a high-resolution sample, but still quite thin. And so you have to be in a very, very thin sample to look at this. The edges, right, have some complications that we'll talk about in more detail. They have not only an onset, but they have what's called near-edge structure, and then they have extended structure. The near-edge structure maps out the density of states available in the material for the electron to scatter into, and they have a secondary structure that's a little further out that can be from electrons interacting with the electrons of nearby atoms as it goes through the material. And I'll go into more detail on that. But these things can actually tell you even more about your sample. Okay? So EELs is actually quite a bit more powerful than EDS in that regard. Here's an example of spectra. This is one of everyone's favorites. It's the boron nitrogen, right? You see that here's boron, here's nitrogen, here's carbon. There is a background, the onset of the boron peak, lots of little wiggles in that, not peak, I said in the onset of that boron edge. There's lots of little wiggles post-edge. There's the carbon, the nitrogen. These little wiggles here are called white lines, and they are associated with particular energy states available in the crystal. The thing that's nice about EELs is you can get this extra information from those, and also you have the ability to go from over a pretty large range of energies to see lots of different stuff. Additionally, because in the microscope, the inelastically scattered electrons are almost all forward scattered, you have a very high amount of collection. And so the numbers of counts that you deal with are very, very high. In EDS, 1,000 counts is good. You know, several thousand counts you worked for. In the case of EELs, you can collect 10 to the 3 or 10 to the 4 counts in a second, right? And so that's a nice thing because you have a very high efficiency in the collection of the electrons. All right, that's just the nature of how the spectrometers work. And just some more examples: carbon, aluminum, silicon, chromium. Some things to look at: K edges always have a very sharp onset, and they tend to have most of their states right after that onset. As you go out to the L edges, these things tend to be broader. You tend to see the L2-3s clustered at the onset edge, the L1 a little bit later. And so these things are a bit more complicated looking. You can have M edges. These ones have a slow rise and what's called a delayed onset, and sometimes a little bit of sharpness. Depends on the nature of the electronic structure in the atom, and again, N edges and the like. So you can detect Ks, Ls, Ms, and Ns. And each of these things, the position tells you what atoms are where. All right? Now, more detail on this. The electron energy loss spectroscopy, what it does, these extra bits of signal after the edge onset experimentally show the available states of that are above the Fermi level in that material. And so what happens is if you have some wiggles after the edge onset, this is more or less a map of the density of states in material above the filled states, the Fermi energy in that material. And so you can use this to look at the electronic structure of the material itself as well. This is pretty powerful because you're able to use electronic structure to understand bonding, right? And with appropriate simulation, you can say this is what the bonding states are in my material. Okay, so EELS has a lot more power. This is a very brief overview. There's a lot to understand in all of this. But the point I want to get through is it's not just that the edge onset tells you what the atom is, the shape of that set of wiggles after there can tell you something about the bonding characteristics that are present too. So EELS is very, very powerful in that regard. Okay, I'll skip that. The near edge structure and the far edge structure. The near edge structure is basically saying, look, I'm going to take some electron and I'm going to have it interact with something in, say, the L state here, and it's able to go to any available empty state, right? That's the truth of any electron, right? If you add more energy into it, it can't go to a filled state. It can only go to an empty state. And so the reason that these things map out the density of available empty states is because there's more available states at particular energies. That's true in all materials. And it's just showing the relative probability of this electron to be excited up to one of these empty states. The extended structure is more about chemical bonding. It's called extended energy loss fine structure. It's a whole other area and one that is more of a research topic at present. I just want to point out that the extra wiggles that come at the end can also be used to tell you something about chemical bonding, and that's about all I want to say on it. Okay? So EELS is something that's it's an area of study in and of itself, and people who are focused on EELS tend to be focused on EELS, and that's what they do. Okay? Now, to show just a very simple reason that this is good, this is one of my favorite examples of this from a colleague of mine who's now at GE Central Research. And what you can do is if you have a different type of bonding in a material, the near edge structure will be different. So this is plotting different types of titanium oxygen bonding states and particular different types of titanium coordination. If you have 3+ or 4+, the shape of that near edge structure will be different, and it will be characteristic of the valence of the electrons that are present. And so if you have a subsequent unknown, in this case he was using a particular boundary, you can use the shape of that unknown and correlate that with knowns to say that at that particular place the valence must be the same. Okay? And so that's indicative, right, of the fact that valence corresponds to electronic structure, it corresponds to available states above the Fermi energy, and you can use that to characterize the material in more detail. Not only what atom is there, but what's its bonding state. And that's pretty cool. I think that's an interesting additional thing to be able to do. Okay? So that's my short talk on EELS. Most analytical microscopes these days will have both EDS and EELS. There's some nice things about each of them. EDS is good for detecting heavy elements. EELS is particularly good at detecting light elements. EELS has great amount of signal collection because most of the electrons are collected at the bottom. The forward scatter of inelastically scattered electrons is directed right down in through the spectrometer. EDS is less good at that because you're only collecting some small angle of the X-rays that come off. The techniques are very complementary, though, in that they're working well with different types of materials. EDS is nice, again, because it has easily quantifiable. You can quantify eels, again, using Cliff Lorimar-type techniques, but it's harder because the background subtractions are a little bit harder. You have to have the samples be very thin so that you're really in a single scattering regime. With respect to spatial resolution, this is stolen from a talk I gave at NSEM a while ago, so it's a little out of date here. But spatial resolution, you want to have a thin sample so that you don't have much beam broadening through there. You'd like to have a field emission source if you can, so you have a small probe. It's pretty common in a thermionic machine, a modern thermionic machine, to get down to a couple nanometers in probe size. But in order to do that in a thermionic, a Lab 6, you're doing that by using a small aperture and a small spot size, and you're throwing away most of your electrons. That's how you get the small probe. In the FEG, because of the coherence of the beam, you instead focus all those down into a small probe, and you still get very good signal to noise. And so if you're doing analytical microscopy, you want to have a FEG. Okay? That's the real driver for those. In the case of EDS, you do have some beam spreading, you do have some spurious X-ray production, and so just because your probe is, 2 nanometers coming in, doesn't mean you're collecting from a 2 nanometer area. Okay? In the case of eels, though, if you focus your probe down to a very small size, you are going to collect the electrons that have lost energy within that very same small volume. And so you can have a much higher spatial resolution on eels than on EDS. Okay? Okay. Also, these things are very sensitive. And it's interesting to define these different types of sensitivities. There's one term that's used that's called minimum mass fraction. And it's like, how much can you detect? If you are using a good system, a FEG, good, well-understood calibration, 1% is pretty doable, okay? You're still good at that point, right? You know what you're doing to get to 1%. People have reported down to numbers like 0.01% or 0.1% with eels, but really 1% is more the number to keep in your head. It depends on the microscope, the sample, and really the quality of the person doing it. But the thing that's also notable is that this is a very small volume that you're probing, right? And so you are able to get very small, you're able to see very small numbers of atoms, okay? And so that's detected, it's called the minimum detectable mass. And it means that because the sample is so thin and the probe is so small, it doesn't take a large number of atoms to detect something, okay? And that's different than some other techniques, right? If you're doing broader area techniques, you have to have lots of atoms to see this same 1%. So that's just something to note. Okay? Now, the final way that you can do all this is with energy-filtered imaging, and I'll just finish this up very, very quickly. If your spectrometer is also equipped with additional lenses, you can use the inelastically scattered electrons and the fact that they are colored by energy loss to image. What you do is you place a energy-selecting slit. It's essentially an aperture. It's a linear aperture. And what it's doing is it's saying, okay, I'm only going to take, and subsequent to this slit, form an image with electrons that have lost a particular energy. And so if you place it around, 529 eV, then you are going to look at the electrons that have lost energy associated with interactions with oxygen. And then the rest of the lenses, it's essentially a second microscope. And what it does is it magnifies and creates an image onto a detector that maps out energy loss spatially. It does this in a single-shot image. Now, that single-shot image may take some large number of seconds to collect, like 20 or 60, but you then get a spatial distribution of the electrons that are there. Again, this is showing a pure silicon sample moving up towards increasing amounts of germanium. And you can do this with relatively high spatial resolution, and it's pretty quick. And you can actually quantify it again if you do the appropriate types of work. So that's energy-filtered imaging, and it just requires you to have a more capable spectrometer at the end. Okay? And so that's the overview of analytical microscopy. You can use EDS, eels, and energy filtering to map out what's in your sample, how much of what's in your sample. With EDS, easy to quantify. With eels, lots more information about bonding. With energy filtered, good to show spatial distribution. And all of these things let you do the necessary work to find out what's in your sample. Okay, so that's the end of the overview of analytical, and that's the end of the MSE 582. So those of you all that are in MSE 582, thanks for coming. And the rest of you, I'll see you on Monday. Okay? And we're going to still have one more lab, right, next week?